Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama gave his second State of the Union address last night, his big framework laying out what he said it will take for Americans together to win the future.
We know what it takes to compete for the jobs and industries of our time. We need to out-innovate, out-educate, and out-build the rest of the world.
How to do all that? With investment, he said, including plenty of public investment and cutting the deficit. He said we have no choice if we want to win. Now, that will be debated. This hour on Point, the President's State of the Union. You can join the conversation. Were you on board with the President last night, nodding yes, nodding no? Has he got the diagnosis right, the medicine right? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's listen to just a little bit more of the president. He said this is this generation's Sputnik moment.
This is our generation's Sputnik moment. 2 years ago, I said that we needed to reach a level of research and development we haven't seen since the height of the space race. And in a few weeks, I will be sending a budget to Congress that helps us meet that goal. We'll invest in biomedical research, information technology, and especially clean energy technology.
President Obama's State of the Union address with Republicans and Democrats sitting all mingled, first time maybe ever. Joining us now from Washington is Howard Fineman, NBC News analyst, senior political editor and columnist for The Huffington Post. Howard Fineman, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. With us from New York is Rich Lowry, editor of The National Review, nationally syndicated columnist. Rich Lowry, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty is here. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Howard and Rich.
Howard, first to you. Sputnik moment. Does that rally the country? What did you see last night?
Well, I saw a marvelous piece of political theater and tactical gamesmanship by the president. I thought he got the tone right, which is that people wanted to hear something uplifting after a really dreary couple of years with a dreary reality still out there. So he pointed toward a more hopeful future. I thought he laid out some ideas that almost no one could disagree with. I thought it was a marvelous moment when everybody stood and clapped for science fairs.
Right.
Who could argue with science fairs?
Right.
And you know, very, very centrist, pro-business, et cetera, and tried to steal a march on the Republicans with the five-year spending freeze. Obviously, it's just the beginning of a long, complicated and tense negotiation with Republicans over what to do about the budget. But I thought it was as good a case as the president could have made for looking towards the future, which is a better debate for him to have than the one about the present.
Rich Lowry, what about the fundamental framing of the country's situation here? We're in a global competition. We've got to get on top of that. That's going to require, yes, cutting the deficit and, yes, in Obama's view, significant public investment. Does that put Republicans in a box? Do they just push straight back? What do you see here, Rich?
Well, I think it was brilliant positioning. He's really trying to take the rhetorical high ground of growth and innovation. And it was just a 60-minute long pep rally for America, you know, celebration of the American idea, the American spirit, the American people, and on and on and on. So rhetorically, there really wasn't anything not to like. So I'm not surprised that the numbers from early viewer reactions are apparently just off the charts. Now, when it comes to the substance, the investments that he talked about is basically the same policy he's been hawking all along. If you look back at his speech when he signed the stimulus back in February 2009, he sold it in exactly the same terms. He talked about the largest investments in education ever and the largest investments in transportation ever and how this would transform us for generations. And, of course, it's turned out to be, in my mind, at least a dismal failure. So when it came to the investments, it seemed to me just trying to put new dressing around the same old policy. And then, you know, on the fiscal portion of it, the last two, which he didn't get to until the last two-thirds or so of the speech, there's really nothing specific. He offered a five-year freeze, which is the same, just a little bit more than the three-year freeze that he had offered before, which substantively is really kind of laughable given the enormous run-up in discretionary spending we've seen over the last 2 years. He took a pass on entitlements and on everything else. So I think it's just rhetorical positioning for, as Howard says, the massive battle over the budget to come.
And a battle over how the country can or should respond to the, what, predicament, the moment that it finds itself in, and it's really throwing down a gauntlet saying we're going to move forward together or not at all here with a House Republican majority now. Let's listen once more to the president.
We will move forward together or not at all. For the challenges we face are bigger than party and bigger than politics. At stake right now is not who wins the next election. After all, we just had an election. At stake is whether new jobs and industries take root in this country or somewhere else.
Jack Beatty, it's all bigger than party. But the medicine he's describing continues to have a lot of public investment in it, which Republicans are now saying, no, this is not the time for that. That takes us right back to party, Jack.
It does. However, unlike the stimulus bill, he's not proposing borrowing. He's proposing reprioritizing, taking subsidies away from oil companies and giving it to green energy, putting it in that direction, cutting corporate taxes and paying it by plugging corporate tax loopholes. So it's rearranging the budget as it is, rather than doing new borrowing. You know, I was struck in the speech by the tension in it between the vision and the voters. The vision is clearly the American, that's the American high. I mean, George Santayana said Americans have only one indigenous religion, belief in the future. Mm. The president staked that. However, the future doesn't vote. And there was so little in there about job creation. There was nothing about foreclosure. And the president's approval ratings, yes, they have improved, but he's still beneath a majority on approval of his handling of the economy. And that goes centrally to jobs, foreclosures, the whole range of problems we've been dealing with. He skipped over that and talked about the sunny future. And the question is whether the voters are going to go for that.
Howard, where does this put the country then in the debate over spending or investment, as the president would put it, versus, you know, throw the brakes on hard and fast right now? We heard from Paul Ryan and Michelle Bachmann after the president for sort of a Republican response and a Tea Party response. Where does it put that debate after this speech?
Well, just beginning all over again. And the argument, the president, I think, succeeded in shifting the attention, as Jack just said, from the dismal present to an argument about the future. And I think he's hoping that that's better ground. I think it has to be for him, given the problems that Jack was mentioning. So then the argument will be between this idea that government can be a generator of jobs through investment, and you can cite Sputnik or the interstate highways or the toll, you know, the roads west and the century and a half ago, or whatever, as he did, all the way back to the beginning, and canals and bridges and whatnot. Or you can say, as the Republicans are saying, look, we agree, we'll accept that debate about the future, but like any family, we have to save, and we're broke, and we have a $14 trillion national debt, and we have $1 trillion a year in deficits, and we just can't afford a government like this, which is too big and is suffocating private capital. That's what the argument's going to be. The president tried to meet that in advance by saying we're going to design a more efficient government, and you have to excuse me for my skepticism after having been in Washington for a long time. I think that's a great idea, a lean, mean, efficient government. And if you can point one out to me, I'd be glad to praise it.
Rich Lowry, though, he pointed abroad and said, you know, look around. Our own engineers give our infrastructure a D. South Koreans have better, what, bandwidth? Europeans and Russians invest more in roads and airports. The Chinese outstripping us. I mean, if it's not public investment, if it's just cut the deficit, where does that leave the Republican mess? Where does it leave this argument for the future? Is it surrender?
Well, I really don't see how it's an either-or proposition. Let's stipulate for the sake of argument, as there is, you know, there's important infrastructure that needs to be funded in this country. I don't think high-speed rail is that. But we obviously need roads. Do you really need a government, federal government, that's spending 25% of GDP to have roads in this country? You can't have roads at 18% of GDP. So I think a lot of this speech was kind of a non sequitur on the important question of how large a government we're going to have and how large a deficit in debt we're going to have. And if we're really going to shift, as Jack suggests, shift things around, if you're shifting it around with a deficit that's $1.3 trillion, I don't think that's very meaningful. And so I think he really took a pass on the big question of, are we going to reduce the deficits in a significant way? And if so, how we're going to do it? And he could get away with that because it's a State of the Union speech. It's a lot of rhetorical fluff. He won't be able to evade it, I don't believe, in his budget, which he'll present in next month. And that's when we'll really get down to brass tacks numbers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's State of the Union speech, America's Sputnik moment, as he put it last night, and what comes now. We're joined in this hour by Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review, joins us from New York. Howard Feynman's in Washington, senior political editor for the Huffington Post, NBC news analyst. Our own news analyst, Jack Beatty's here as well. Here's the president talking last night about going at not that spending, but the deficit. Said the government spends more than it takes in.
So tonight, I am proposing that starting this year, we freeze annual domestic spending for the next 5 years. Now, this would reduce the deficit by more than $400 billion over the next decade and will bring discretionary spending to the lowest share of our economy since Dwight Eisenhower was president.
And that's not all he said. There would have to be more. Let's listen.
Most of the cuts and savings I proposed only address annual domestic spending, which represents a little more than 12% of our budget. To make further progress, we have to stop pretending that cutting this kind of spending alone will be enough. It won't.
Lots of response online from our listeners. Here's B complaining about empty platitudes and vagaries. Here's Yar says, kudos for President Obama, hopeful speech. And here's Brian says, the president's a master of political jujitsu. What about it, Rich Lowry? He says, cut this, freeze for 5 years, and we'll have discretionary spending to the lowest share of our economy since Dwight Eisenhower was president. That sounds persuasive.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. But it gets to the real problem. As Obama noted elsewhere in the address, discretionary spending is such a small portion of the budget because the entitlements have become such a huge portion of the budget. And, there was some talk prior to this address that President Obama might take the lead on Social Security reform or some aspect of entitlements, and he utterly failed to do that. And then you had Paul Ryan giving the response, and he's famous for crafting a very specific, a far-reaching plan for reform of entitlements, and he didn't mention any specifics either. So you're really going to have this jockeying over who's going to go first or if anyone is going to go first on entitlements. And I think politically Republicans just have to be very cautious here, because I think one of the implicit warnings from President Obama's address last night is if they get out in front on entitlements at all, he will just absolutely hammer them and demagogue them to kingdom come.
Well, where did you see the springboard for that? Because he himself said we've got to look at Medicaid, Medicare. He said it's not enough to look at this discretionary spending. Where did you see this?
Because
the setup
there are
for the hammer?
No specifics whatsoever. It was all extremely vague. On Social Security, he said, let's have a bipartisan solution, and then he went on to stipulate all the things that we shouldn't do that really cut the legs out of any possible bipartisan solution. So I think it was kind of the typical tone music on entitlements with no substance whatsoever, leaving his powder dry for if Republicans actually tiptoe out onto the Ryan plan to try to cut the limb right under their legs. And that would be, for me, a fairly obvious political play. And if there's one thing about President Obama's political strategy in reaction to the midterms the last couple months, I think, has been quite effective. It's also been blatantly obvious. I think a child could have written this strategy with a crayon. It's just it's a paint by numbers move to the center. And Democrats, if you look at Bill Clinton, he recovered by moving to the center and also by just hammering Republicans on entitlements.
Howard Fineman, doesn't this cut both ways, though? Because the president, though there were not specifics there, and he mentioned his own deficit commission, but he didn't endorse exactly their findings. On the other hand, he said very clearly, we're going to have to go further than just this discretionary stuff. It's going to have to be bigger. If he heads into a re-election season or the next election campaign without having moved on that, doesn't it make mock of the balance he's suggesting here between spending and deficit reduction?
Well, he will have to calculate how much benefit he gets politically from cutting the budget in a significant way versus how much he gets from standing as the protector of Social Security, to oversimplify only slightly. I love Jack's quote about the future doesn't vote, but the past does, meaning senior citizens. And Social Security, changes in Social Security are still something that for most voters, most people who turn out to vote, is a very, very dicey thing politically. And Rich is right about that. And the Republicans do have to be careful. And the president's kind of going to try to invite them in. I think the AARP is upset that the president even mentioned Social Security within the framework of discussing deficit reduction. They think that's an outrage because, in their view, Social Security is very well funded. It shouldn't even be in that discussion.
Even though what he said was, we will strengthen Social Security.
Yes, and he also, and Rich is right, he laid down markers for what he would not accept that really make substantial savings very, very difficult. So, but that's going to be one of the big questions for the next election cycle is the extent to which Social Security becomes part of the discussion. I would bet in the end that it doesn't.
I want to get our listeners in right here. Mark in Amherst, Massachusetts. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Earlier, I think you said, where do we come down on public investment? Personally, I support it. There was a line in his speech, and he said this before. Americans are living within their own means. They should expect the government to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's almost verbatim.
Yep.
And he knows better. I mean, that kind of economic reasoning is superficial at best. In 2008, we had a massive collapse in demand of, $3 trillion?
And he stood up for that, though. He said we put the stimulus money there to prevent a worse collapse. But what, you think he's trying to have it both ways with that family budget metaphor?
I think he's trying to have it both ways. And I think the problem is, in my read on the American public and American politics, is they have both those thoughts in their head at the same time, both thoughts being we want to reduce unemployment and we want to reduce government spending. And not only do they have them both in their head at the same time, they think they're actually logically connected, whereas, in fact, they're inimical to one another. So by doing this, and he knows that. I mean, he's got to know that. He's smart. So he is reinforcing a means that's only going to play into the hands of those who perhaps unwittingly would just make the unemployment situation worse.
Yeah, Mark, we've got to, I appreciate your call, Jack. Mark calls it a meme. You know, others may call it a dire deficit threat to the future of the nation. It depends how you look on it. I mean, go straight at this public investment question, if you would, Jack. Here you had Paul Ryan in his response talking repeatedly about the failed stimulus, to Mark's general point there. The president saying it was necessary to keep us from being in worse shape, but saying we've got to invest in the future. Do you see the GOP ready to do that in this time of big budget acts? And if we don't, does it look like a kind of surrender?
Well, it certainly can be billed as a surrender. I thought the big line there was from Robert Kennedy that the future is an achievement, something you have to make. The Republicans argue, well, get out of the way, government, and the people, the economy, entrepreneurs, they will make the future. You can argue, of course, that the Republican model of the 19th century is the one that the president is talking about, which was, of course, public improvements, infrastructure spending, land-grant colleges, all the rest, that those are the things, those are the catalyzing things that government can do to support the private economy. But, you know, on Mark's point, I couldn't agree with him more. That line leapt out at me as well. That legitimated that line about, well, the public balances its budget. What about the government? That's to say that the paradox of thrift, which John Maynard Keynes said was really what happens in depressions. People think they need to save more. They do save more. It's a good thing to save. However, that individual decision redounds to the detriment of the economy. Everybody is saving. They're not spending.
Even at $14 trillion, Jack, is there no end point to that argument?
Well, no, of course, but at 9% unemployment. We're not talking 5% unemployment. It seems to me you don't want to legitimate that essentially Hooverian notion of the economy, because unless the government acts, where, as Mark said, where is that $2 trillion shortfall? How is that going to be made up?
Howard, dive in on this, because you expressed skepticism earlier about the government's role. Yet here's the president raising the Sputnik crisis as his kind of starting point here. And if you look at what happened after Sputnik, of course, I mean, you had huge government investment in research, you know, many multiples of what we had been spending before on all kinds of scientific research. A lot of it through the Defense Department, not only there, big investments all over to catch up. Are you saying with your skepticism, Howard, that kind of investment the president's talking about no longer works today? We shouldn't, couldn't, can't do it? And is that nihilism, or where does that leave us?
No, I'm not saying that. I
think that I'm the nihilistic one here.
Right.
Yeah, I deliberately put it to Howard. We'll come to your nihilism, Rich.
I'll leave that to Rich. I think we do have a rich history of government sort of helping to set the framework, the girders, if you will, to build America. And that, as I said, that's true of roads in the old days and public improvements and land-grant colleges and the space race and million other things you can name. I just thought the idea that we're going to save a lot of money by streamlining government is something that I've heard ever since I got here, and it never seems to happen. Government is an awkward instrument sometimes. It achieves things through brute power and more money than any private enterprise can summon. But the difference between now and the Sputnik days is that we were coming out of World War II. We had begun to pay down the debt of that. America was ready to invest. It had the capacity to invest. And it was much stronger relative to the rest of the world economically, with a much lower sort of carrying cost of social spending than we have now. It's more difficult now because we have an aging baby boom generation, because we have much more generous social programs than we did in the late 50s.
Yep.
So it's a different situation, and I think it's right for the president to summon us to a moment like that, but it has to be done with a clear-eyed realization that we're a different, to some extent, at least fiscally, we are a different country from what we were 50 years ago.
Rich, Lowry, you've got a big conservative view and conservative megaphone. What about his essential framing of the moment we're at? Do you agree with that, that we're in this global competition, that things aren't going so well, that we've got all kinds of problems in the foundation of our economy, our infrastructure, as he put it, that we've got to do something about that via the federal government?
Well, everyone talks about competitiveness, you know, Republicans, Democrats, everyone. I don't see a competition with China as really a zero-sum game. China's not responsible for our economic problems. When it comes to the manufacturing sector, you've seen a reduction in manufacturing jobs, and Obama referred to this in the speech primarily as a matter of technology and increased productivity. We're making more stuff in terms of its value than we did in the 1950s. It's just you can do it with many fewer people. And I find the whole Sputnik and moonshot thing just such a cliche, and I don't think it's terribly apt, partly for the reasons that Howard just outlined. But if it's really a Sputnik moment and we're going to react in the same way, okay, let's import a bunch of former Nazi rocket scientists, you know, to help us in the space race. And the moonshot was a fairly discreet engineering endeavor. Now, it was a massive engineering challenge, and it was a stupendous achievement, but that's something that's relatively easy to do.
But it wasn't alone. I mean, they put a big new program in to bring out all kinds of more engineers and research that went all over the place. I mean, the Internet came out of ARPA, DARPA, and
yeah,
and all the rest.
But if you look at it in today's terms, its cost was, I think, inflation-adjusted terms. Getting on the mood cost us about, you know, 1/7 of what the stimulus was. And two, it's much easier to engage in some engineering project than it is to reform American education. I mean, let's be honest. We have, since the 1970s, spent massive amounts of federal funds on education in serial versions of kind of Sputnik moments and great waves of reform. And our test scores have not budged.
Well, look at every survey, though, Rich.
The idea that you can analogize an engineering project to send, you know, a rocket to the moon to reforming American education, which involves a lot of entrenched interests, involves a lot of complex social issues, is really, I don't think, is apt at all.
Yet, you know, he's trying to strike a hopeful note. You look at all the surveys, they say Americans are really worried. You may not be, but Americans are about the future.
I am worried. And I think the mood music was fine. And I think it was good, and people are going to react to it. People love optimism. They love talk of the future. But substantively, I think it was either lacking or positively evaded. The real issues come
Does it leave Republicans, though, at risk of looking, you know, if it's not like, let's dive in and attack these problems together, do Republicans look like they've got a sort of, you know, I've got mine, Jack, or every man for himself view?
Well, I think there's a political danger to Republicans on a couple fronts. One, people in theory want to reduce government spending and reduce the deficit. How does that sentiment hold up when you get really to brass tacks, cutting the domestic discretionary budget by about 20%, which is going to be painful cuts across the board and is going to present countless opportunities for Democrats to point to specific programs that are popular and say, look, they're being gutted or decimated. That's one big vulnerability. The other is what we've been talking about here rhetorically. If Republicans become the party of grim austerity, it may be that that sells because it's a new political moment and people are so concerned about the deficit and the debt, but that would be something utterly new because usually the happy talk and the vague generalities when it comes to budgeteering win out.
Jack,
as Ronald Reagan proved.
Does Obama take the Reagan chair here, Jack Beatty?
I think that's what he's trying to occupy. And Paul Ryan was in the eat your spinach position, and I think Dick Cheney was right some years ago when he said, you know, Reagan proved the public doesn't care about this. They don't care about the deficit as a as an abstract proposition.
I think there's been a learning curve since then,
perhaps, but it's a tougher, you know, Paul Ryan gave a very, you could say realistic, grimly realistic might be more appropriate. And now, let's stipulate that a lot of that is the truth. I mean, my gosh, we have this tremendous debt problem looming. But is that sellable? And then the picking of Ryan. You know, he wasn't just anybody. He's got a real tough program to get there.
That even a lot of Republicans haven't signed on to.
That's right.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the president's big State of the Union speech last night, where that leaves him, where it leaves the country, where it leaves you, with Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review, Howard Feinman of Huffington Post and NBC News, our own Jack Beatty. Here's the president last night. It was interesting. I mean, he was getting to this, fear, maybe, that our system itself may be so bound up in politics that it's just not working. He compared it I guess he's thinking China here, countries with kind of command and control.
If the central government wants a railroad, they build a railroad, no matter how many homes get bulldozed. If they don't want a bad story in the newspaper, it doesn't get written. And yet, as contentious and frustrating and messy as our democracy can sometimes be, I know there isn't a person here who would trade places with any other nation on earth.
And right there, maybe aside from his praising words for the military, got what might have been the biggest applause line of the night. He had applause lines, Rich, that nobody could sit down for there. Happy to be an American. We've got all kinds of response here. Renee says, I'm wondering how many members of Congress have been to China and India to see our competition and understand it. They should take a bipartisan tour to see firsthand what we're competing with, or at the very least, she writes, read Tiger Mom. And here's another one. This is a little long, but it gets to, I wonder if this may not be, you know, political pundits and reporters, they have our view. But here, in the typical Obama style, writes our listener, the speech balanced all sides, suggested that all points of view are actually essential to suggest. He didn't just talk about investment. Democrats also talked about making cuts, bringing the deficit under control. And then there's the basic philosophy that compromise and listening to all points of view isn't a weakness, but actually result in stronger solutions, is at the heart of Obama. People who don't get that or are addicted to divisive politics see this either as empty speech, weakness, or disingenuous. So there's someone who sees strength in what others call platitudes, Howard Fineman. What do you say?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I do think that this situation now plays to the president's strengths, to his character, to his upbringing, to who he is. I've always thought he was more judicial in his temperament, and I think he likes to get all points of view there and likes to be seen as the guy who can be the moderating influence. That's the way he was at the Harvard Law Review. That's the way he was in his personal life.
Back on his home turf here.
Yeah, this is a better situation for him, really, than when he had control of Congress and he had to be the crusader and he had to join arms with the other Democrats lockstep. This is much better for him and who he is. But let's be honest, there are also moments of great contentiousness in the last couple of years, and he threw some pretty sharp elbows, too. So now he's stepping back and saying, oh, let's all be friends. I mean, there was a time when he was standing toe-to-toe with the Chamber of Commerce, which is located right across the street from the White House. So, but this suits him better, and I thought that's one of the reasons why I thought this was such a good speech last night politically for him, because this is Barack Obama saying the things that he's most comfortable saying and in the role he's most comfortable in. He wasn't defensive at all. You notice he didn't attempt to defend the stimulus package in any detail. He didn't talk about the jobs creator because he knows that. Yeah. That thing is not going to fly right now. And now he's posing as the judge who will, in a Solomon-like fashion, decide which department gets to control salmon in America.
And at the same time, lauding House Speaker John Boehner as the symbol of American opportunity up
right,
from the barkeep's
exactly.
son. Berea, Kentucky, Laura's calling. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say the lion's share of the budget goes to the Pentagon. And there's an old saying, you can't have battle and butter. There's no talk of this enormous funding for the Pentagon in those wars. And let's talk about the elephant in the room, and that pun is intended, because those trillions were really pulled up by these wars. So I'm upset that I don't hear anybody here talking about it. I don't hear President Obama talking about it. I had a son that was damaged by this war.
Mm-hmm.
And what are we going to do about this when that's the most of the money is being spent in the Pentagon.
There was very little talk about that last night, though there was some. He talked about the Pentagon being ready to make cuts, and the cameras, of course, all panned to the Secretary of Defense, Jack Beatty. What about that when it comes to working out this big, we must invest, but we also must cut vision?
Well, you know, I think he can actually find some Republican votes there. I wonder what Rich feels on that. I've just noticed lately some Tea Party people have spoken to defense budget. There's been criticism. I've sensed
we had
more
Ron
criticism.
Paul on saying
that's right.
There.
That's right. I've heard more. And of course, the Tea Party people get it that Pentagon spending is all about congressional boondoggles and, you know, payoffs to constituency groups. They get that. And I've also heard more criticism of Afghanistan policy from Republicans lately. Not a critical mass of Republicans, but more of it and more vocal. So I think that the president, that there may actually be more room there for cuts, for perhaps rapider withdrawal from Afghanistan than the president is allowing. However, of course, he keeps moving the goalpost. He did say we're going to start bringing people home from Afghanistan this summer, but Joe Biden, in his latest trip there, pretty much pushed the real drawdown ahead for another 3 years. I just think the public is going to catch up to the president before that and demand more action.
Rich Lowry, what about the GOP on that front? You're looking for cuts, looking for ways.
Sure. First of all, obviously, we should say thank you to the caller and to her son for his
yes, indeed,
sacrifice and his service. There's more sentiment for cutting defense on the right than you've seen in a long time. It's still a minority sentiment. I mean, look, we are involved in a real live shooting war in Afghanistan. And speaking of competition with China, we do have a rising ambitious power that wants to extend its influence out into the Western Pacific, and we will need to have the capabilities on the sea and in the air to deter that. So I think it would be, speaking of investments, it would just be foolish to cut deeply into defense, or certainly to do it willy-nilly without any consideration of the larger strategic issues. I'd just like to follow up on one thing Howard was saying about the speech and how it suits Obama. I absolutely agree with that, and it was kind of a return of the 2004 convention speech, Obama, and I think it was the return of the Obama that a lot of people, certainly in the center, thought they were electing in 2008. And this is something that irks and chagrins me, but this is the way Obama, I thought, should have sounded, should have governed in his first 2 years. Instead, he governed much further to the left. And it may be that turns out to be a brilliant strategy, because he's created facts on the ground in terms of spending, in terms of health care, that will be very hard to reverse. So if he's created those facts on the ground at the same time that he can make people kind of forget about the more left-wing partisan Obama the first 2 years through speeches like this one, he'll really get to both the best of both worlds.
Howard Feynman, well, Rich, what about it? Howard.
I was going to say, if that's the case, then he writes pretty well in crayon, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But is that a fair characterization, Howard, so far to the left? We've heard it a lot, but is it he was so far to the left or others were far to the right?
No, well, it depends on your historical perspective and your politics and your ideology. I think he spent a lot of money. And I think the stimulus, I try to look at things as dispassionately as I can. I think the stimulus was poorly done overall. And the fact that he was so silent about it last night, I think, proves my point on that.
Defenders say without it, we would have been in the ditch.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot
doesn't
of it
mean
just,
you couldn't have done it better.
Yeah, it was not well done. It was not well designed or well done. As he even admitted, he said that, you know, the phrase shovel ready is the biggest lie in government. That was his reasoning and defense. But I think that on health care, he spent a year on that. I thought initially, and I still think it was overall not a good political play for him. It used up a lot of ammunition. He spent a whole year on it. He managed to get everybody upset. But now that's passed. And as Rich says, all of that's out there. And I thought it was interesting last night. The president is now in the posture of trying to defend the big health care reform legislation as a budget saver, as something that's really going to save a lot of money in the future. And he's going to try to defend and deflect against against cuts in Medicare and Medicaid and so forth in entitlements by saying, wait a minute, we've got this health care reform line that's going to save us money. And that's going to force the Republicans to argue about the existing law and its utility rather than trying to start from scratch.
Let's go to Mountain Home, Arkansas, and Mac. Mac, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Mac. You're on. What do you see? What do you think?
Yes, well, all I can see is the politician and the president not hearing what the people have said last year in the election and leading up to the election, because what we need is a deep cut in spending. And all he's talking about is investing, which equals spending. Now, I understand that we have, you know, we have painful choices to make. I understand that. But American people have had painful choices to make for at least the last 3 years. And why is the government just able to continue spending when we clearly do not have the money to spend?
Mac, what are you thinking when the president says we've got to make these investments so we don't fall behind China and the rest of the world? We are being left behind, he said. We need to get in there and invest in our future. What are you thinking when he says that?
I'm thinking that he's trying to promote fear of what China's doing and somehow make us spend the money that we do not have to spend.
Mac, I appreciate your call. Rich Lowry, if the Republicans are going to have their boat floated, Mac's view is the one that will do it. Do you think it prevails?
Well, that's the big question. You know, on this whole Keynesian question, I was also struck, like as Howard was, there was really no substantial defense of the stimulus whatsoever. That thing turned out to be such a political dog, and I think substantively it didn't work for a couple reasons. One, I just think the whole Keynesian model is so simplistic that you get a hole in demand, and then you plug it up with government money, and everything's fine. But the fact is an economy, a $14 trillion economy, is just a much more complex animal than that. And what we learned is you can spend a lot of money and still not really deal with the fundamental drags on the economy.
Fair enough, Rich. But
market will still be down, and the banks will still be weak, and consumers will still need to, households will still need to heal their own balance sheets. And then, if you actually look where the money went, you know, a lot of it was for tax credits, and the evidence suggests that was saved by households rather than spent. And then a lot of it went to local and state governments. And if you look at the figures, you'll see local and state governments cut down on their own borrowing as soon as that money came in. So
but we were
really
told.
Doing,
but we were told by
borrowing, borrowing in order to reduce local and state borrowing.
You know, I got that, Rich. But we were told by George Bush's people as well. Do this, or this $14 trillion economy could go down.
Now, I think you're thinking of TARP. Now,
well, that was the beginning of this response, right?
TARP is a different animal.
Of course, but
do something to stem the financial panic. I think TARP was not particularly well designed either, and you can do counterfactuals all day long on whether it worked or not. I still support it as a prudential act, because when you have financial crises of that nature and a financial panic, you have to pump liquidity into the system. Now, the $800 billion stimulus was a different proposition, and I'm pretty confident it was just wasted money.
Well, wide interpretation on that. A lot of economists saying we had to have it as well, though the way it was spent, you can certainly argue all day about that. Shenandoah, Virginia. George, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to comment because I think while the speech was fine, both sides, or every side of the arguments, are ignoring facts that really need to be put out there, because no politician of any stripe can respond to them.
Like what?
One of them, for instance, on education. Throwing money at education no longer works. Why? Because if you look at the facts, the degrees and the age of the people teaching, who are in the teaching profession, are already so young that they're no longer of an age when they were trained that they got the quality that the teachers who came through the system and got trained in the 40s and 50s got.
So we're a few generations into that problem, and you're jaundiced about fixing it. George, our time is short, but let me just pick that up. I mean, Jack, this is so interesting here. You know, in some ways, the president last night saying we've got this big challenge, trying to take the country back to the Sputnik moment and what we saw as American success in responding to that. On the other hand, you've got citizens, maybe journalists too, who almost feel too knowing about the complexity of the problems now. But if the country doesn't respond to a clarion call like that, maybe not in the detail, but at least the ambition to work its way out of the hole, what does that say?
Well, you know, it is a different climate, isn't it? I think in the 1960s, something like 64% of people had confidence in government. They were coming out of the New Deal, coming out of the great post-war boom. Today, I don't know what the figures are, probably half that or less. It's a different situation, and there is such a thing today as informed alienation, you know, informed blanket skepticism, just as this gentleman was indicating. We have been spending more on education every year, and the results seem, in aggregate, compared to other countries, to be not there. And so, yes, it's tough for a president to make such arguments. However, I do think he was helped in that anybody, when they think about it, you know, private companies can't build roads. They can't educate the kids. They can't clean the air. They can't really engage in fundamental research because there's no payoff for it. Those things are in the government's bailiwick. And I think that may be a majority view. I don't know.
Well, we will see soon enough. The president's high note last night and the skepticism came right behind it from Paul Ryan, from Michelle Bachmann. Been great looking in to this speech and the country's moment with the three of you, and I'm really grateful to you for your time. Rich Lowry at the National Review, really appreciate your time and insights. Rich, thank you so much
for joining us
today. Howard Fineman at the Huffington Post and NBC News is an analyst there. Howard, it's always great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
And Jack, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, become a fan on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.